Welcome to this week's episode of the Greg Hughes Podcast. And my guest today is a woman who's redefined what is possible through sheer resilience and independent thinking. Carolyn Murray, the Director and General Manager of the Shandon Hotel and Spa and Chairperson of the Donegal Branch of the Irish Hotels Federation, has built a career defined not by professional titles, but by the legacy she's creating for her family and her region. From her early years in Derry, where a simple gift from her parents, a tracksuit, became a lifelong symbol of sacrifice and the power of possibility, to navigating the depths of personal tragedy in her youth, Carolyn's journey is one of immense character. She's become a leading voice in the Northwest, proving that excellence is not confined to capital cities and that strength does not always arrive loudly. Today, we discuss the evolution of her leadership, the vital importance of fostering a culture of support, and how motherhood has fundamentally reshaped her perspective on success. This is a story about building a life of meaning after loss and ensuring that the next generation grows up believing that where you begin in life does not limit where you can go. Please welcome on to the podcast our guest, Carolyn Murray. Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us. It really is appreciated.
Thank you, Greg.
Right. You know, I mean, obviously podcasts like this, especially when we want to get to know someone a little bit better, they're always going to start with our childhood because it either defines who we are or directs where we go in life. So where were you born and where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Derry City in a council estate called Ballymacgorty, known as Ballymac. So Ballymacgorty would have been a place at that time when I grew up as well. There wasn't a lot of employment. You know, there was a lot of parents out of work and it was tough. You know, it was just like every other council estate. It was tough to get shoes for school, all the wee small things that people, kids these days, wouldn't even think about. So that's where it all started, in Ballymac.
Yeah. Happy childhood? Because sometimes, you know, our happiness is not always equated to how prosperous our families are, right?
Oh, yeah. There were six of us and we had a very happy childhood. My parents both decided that one of them would work at a time. So sometimes my mum would be at work and sometimes my dad would be at work. So we always had one parent that was there getting you up for breakfast, great routine. They were there when you came home for dinner. And, you know, we had family holidays every year, even though we might have had, you know, holes in our school shoes, but we still had 2 weeks in Bundoran every year.
Fantastic stuff. And what a place to go on a holiday. How conscious were you of how hard your mum and dad had to work or the accommodations they had to make to sort of give you that 2 week holiday or other little treats that would come along? Because, you know, again, and we've got amazing young people now, but I'm as guilty as anyone. Sometimes things come a little bit too easy and when it does, you don't appreciate it. I'm just curious, were you an appreciative child? Did that click with you?
Yes, very much so, because even out of my peer group, we would have had a bit less. So the way it was in our house, every Thursday the shopping was done and you got one bar of chocolate, one bag of crisps, one apple and one banana for the whole week. So yes, and there was lots of times where mum and dad would just say, you can't go, we don't have it. And I can only imagine now saying that to my two teenage girls. We don't have the money. Like, they just, can you put money in my Revolut constantly? So, yes, I fully appreciated it. And when you did get something, and when you did go on holiday, or when you did have a nice steak dinner once a month.
It meant something, didn't it? Yeah. And I don't know what it's like in your house, but sometimes you see it in my house, or I see it in others, is that almost, you know, especially with you being a young mum of teenagers, where's the mum, where's the friend, or where's the confidant, where's the authority? And, you know, I think when I was growing up, and I'm much older than you, Carolyn, but when I was growing up, it was a very defined parent-child relationship.
Definitely. It's all changed these days, you know, like obviously I'm a single parent now too, and, you know, going through divorce and that, it's difficult at times because you're the only parent there. So like having two teenage girls and you come home from work, all the offloading of all the emotions throughout the day, you have to deal with that all by yourself. But yes, you want to comfort them, you want to be there for them. I think kids now, they share their emotions a lot more than we would have done growing up. So you've got all that overload, and then when you actually try and tell them or discipline them, they nearly laugh at you.
Yeah, that's true. But I suppose, you know, when a family goes through a difficult experience, like a family breakup, and you're trying to adopt a couple of roles, you might try and protect your children from it, but it's so ever present, they are going to understand what's going on as well.
Oh, they do. I mean, they
have. And that makes you grow quick.
It does. Yeah. And, you know, they it's really tough on kids. You know, they grieve everything as much as the couple that breaks up does. And my two girls, like, when we were together as a family, it was a happy family, according to them. And so they miss that part of it. So it's difficult at times, and you're trying to comfort them and you're trying to be there for them, but you're trying to deal with your own challenges as well, you know.
It's a lot of, but I suppose it's like anything, isn't it, Carolyn, in caring, you know, to be a good carer, you have to, they say, look after yourself first, you know, on the airplane, put the life vest on yourself first, and then you can help other people. But I think that's easier said than done.
It is.
Often.
It is. And, you know, I think one of the biggest achievements for me is probably me and my girls have a happy home now. You know, we have peace, we have laughter, people can come and go. It's just a lovely environment. And, you know, it took a while to get there, but it's definitely in that space now, and it's great.
Fantastic. Was there a defining moment in your childhood that sort of made you realise, I suppose, you know, the sacrifices maybe that were being made? Or, I think you've talked of a moment, just something really simple, like getting an item of clothing, right? But it sort of meant something more significant than it was at the time.
I think growing up in Ballymacorty, it was just a massive achievement just to get a job.
Yeah.
They have a full-time job. So growing up, all I wanted was to be able to work and have a decent job. Like we were told growing up, you know, there's not going to be any money to go to university. You had to leave school at 16. You had to get a job. You had to provide and help the family out, because there was a lot of us. So there was no big aspirations of, you know, getting a really good job or going to university or becoming a specialist in anything. It was literally, there was a lot of pride in just working.
So you didn't feel, was there a level of acceptance to that then when you were at that age, when you were having that conversation, or was there a bit of resentment there? Or not of life, by the way, I don't mean of an individual.
We didn't know any different.
That was just life.
Yeah, it was like, that was an achievement if you got a job when you left school when you were 16 and you worked full time and you never missed work and you never, no matter how sick you were, you know, that was just the standard, and we didn't know any different at that time.
Does it frustrate you, and not talking about any present staff or any present jobs, right, but like I think I see a bit of me in you in that if you're going to do something, right, you want to do it 100%. Mm-hmm. And you don't really want to do it unless you can give it 100%. But then if you need the people around you or those that you're working with to try and have that same passion. And it can be frustrating when you don't see that. Yeah. Like sometimes, why does this not mean as much to you as it does to me?
Yeah.
Is that part of your personality?
It definitely is. And I went through that for several years when we were building the Shandon. But the key is, there's lots of people like us out there, and it was just finding those right people to surround myself with. And people couldn't work with me that didn't have the same attitudes. We didn't end up working together for too long. So there's plenty of horror stories there, but there's two sides to every story. But definitely the people that I have around me now are the reason the Shandon is a success.
So that's really quite interesting. So the real foundations was you getting the right people in there, and then the bricks and mortar follows.
That's the key, and that's the key to any. I mean, a hotel isn't just beds and food and everything else. It's the people, and it's how people feel or made to feel by my team when they come, and that's why they come back. And then the passion in the team too. Like most of my senior managers have been with me from previous hotel, from the Mount Errigal Hotel. So some of them have been working with me now 17 years.
Mm. And that works too, because at the same time too, whomever replaces you, they have their own
team
way of thinking as well, and the people they want around them. So it works really quite well. And you didn't ask them to move too far, which is always which is always good. Was working in hospitality for you a little bit of inevitability, given what you were surrounded by as a child? Your mother also worked in hospitality, is that right?
My mum climbed the ranks very quick and managed several kitchens in Derry City. And my dad was also a journalist, a sports editor. So at first I went under the media and went under the Derry News as an advertising sales rep. And my dad was the sports editor. My brother was the graphics design manager. And I was only 16 and the job came up in the paper. And both of them said, don't you dare apply for that. You will absolutely show us up. You're only 16 and they'll just give you the job because of us. So I went ahead and applied for it anyway. And the sales manager at the time came down. He said, look, Neil, I have given your daughter the job. I know she's just out of school and she's only 16, but she's so hungry, you know, and she's told me that she's going to work harder than anyone else that I employ. And I spent 5 years there. And I think I was only 18 when I became an advertising sales manager.
Unbelievable, yeah. Isn't it? Did people understand once they were working with you that you were there on merit and ability? Or did you have to sort of work a bit harder to prove you weren't a nepo baby or whatever that terminology is?
Yeah, I was basically like shunned by the other sales reps. There was 10 employed at the time. Imagine back in the day, 10 sales reps for a local newspaper.
My word, unbelievable stuff.
But then it was like they were all kind of, there was 10 employed, but there was only maybe 3 jobs and I managed to stay on. But I had to prove myself to my brother and my dad and then obviously my colleagues. And again, my daughters too have the same thing. Coming into the Shandon, people think, oh, you got that because you know someone. But sometimes those people have to work that wee bit harder to prove themselves.
I think they do, yeah, because you get found out very quick if you don't know what you do, don't you? And I think really that, you know, pressure makes diamonds, doesn't it? I think that's what they say. So, you know, it's good. Yeah. So what I'm getting from you so far, you know, between your upbringing, sort of understanding the value of something, you know, what goes into actually creating it and this is the formation of who you are now then, isn't it? This is your personality forming as a younger person, yeah, through life in Derry, watching your mum and dad, proving yourself in the paper, mm-hmm, getting to the top there, 18.
Yep, everything was going well. And then when I was 18 then, my sister tragically died in my arms from an asthma attack. We had a holiday home in the Downings. It was my partner Chris's caravan. And the next morning, now she always had brittle asthma, so she always did suffer, but it would flare up, you know, and there'd be times she would have no issues. But this particular time in the Downings that morning, she took a severe asthma attack and she died in my arms on the way when we were trying to meet the ambulance. So in the back of the car, she tragically, like I knew that she had died because I couldn't feel her pulse and I couldn't feel any breath because she was lying on me. But They got her on life support then, and obviously the hope that everybody had, her husband, she had 2 young kids, and my parents and my brothers and sisters, everybody thought that she was going to be okay, but I knew she was gone for too long. Wow. You know, so after 2 days of everyone being so hopeful and praying and the Padre Pio glove and everything, in my heart I knew, but I couldn't share it with anyone because I didn't want to break their hope.
No.
But obviously, there was no brain activity, so they had to turn the machines off after 2 days.
How did you cope with that?
People always say, oh, you're so strong and everything else, but you're not at the time. You just, I think it's just shock and survival and just being able to get up in the morning and put one foot in front of the other at times like that. And I don't know if I coped with it very well. I think then, you know, I'm such an empath that I was worried about my mum.
Yeah.
I was worried about my sister's kids, like me and my sister. There's only 5 years between us. I was only 18. She was only 5 years older. So we were best friends as well. And then her husband, who was left with 2 kids. And obviously me and Chris, my partner at the time, we were there for Kevin, her husband, her late husband. He's now dead too. And the 2 kids. But it was just, I think I just went into a mode of just trying to help everybody else.
Mm-hmm. And did that help you, or did it defer perhaps?
I think it deferred it for a while, and then just throwing yourself into work. Like, I just completely, and God forgive me, but it kind of catapulted my career, and then I became the advertising sales manager because being at home and being alone was too much to deal with.
Yeah.
So I literally just worked around the clock.
People listening, you know, will understand that this is the most horrendous thing anyone could ever go through, you know, their best friend, close sister. But the fact that you were there with her when she passed, is that a blessing or a curse? Is it a blessing that you were there with her in those final moments, or is it something that you've had to carry with you the whole time, Karen?
Sorry.
It's okay. Do you want to move on to...
It's okay. No one's ever asked me that question.
I'm sorry.
It's just difficult because... Oh, catch my breath. Nowadays, you have so much training in the hotel business and, you know, first responder, and, like, I'm a first responder and there's 20 of my team trained. If we had had that training back then, she'd probably still be alive, you know, but back 20-odd years ago, nobody knew what to do. Even with her asthma, you think that we would have knew to, like, try and learn compressions or something, you know, so... That's difficult, but at the same time, I was there with her when she passed, so that is nice. But at the same time, you still feel guilty that now that with my knowledge now, obviously I didn't have it then, maybe we could have done something, you know?
Yeah, there's an obvious thing I could say, but I don't think this is something that you've thought about and you've already worked out yourself. Nothing I'm going to say is going to... But there is nothing else you could have done because you had that knowledge at that time.
That's it. We didn't
and
know that.
We can't change history that we've got much more awareness of CPR. And it's just all we can do is, I suppose, is focus on that she wasn't alone, that she had her best, her favourite person with her outside of the children.
Yeah.
Did it's interesting that you say that this sort of spurred you on, and I can actually see the logic to that. But before I get back to that point and pick up on that point, what you did do subsequently, though, is trying to, you know, make some changes and promote EpiPens, etc., something that might prevent a person going through what your sister went through.
Yeah, me and my family, then we did a bit of campaigning after she died, because asthma is an allergy reaction as well at times, and I think, like, I'm not a doctor, I don't understand all the medical stuff, but I do know that any time she did go into hospital, adrenaline was the first thing that they would give her, and that would really settle her down. So we were campaigning at the time to have EpiPens given to asthma patients, but we weren't successful at the time. I'm not sure now if that's the case, but it is something that, you know, we felt so strongly at the time. We were just too far away from the Downings to the Letterkenny Hospital. And if she had got there quicker, if we had had, like, she always had nebulizers, you know.
But there's lots of maybes in there, isn't there? Because even her transportation to the hospital, and this is stuff that was actionable at the time. You know, you can beat yourself up about if we had time machines, right? But that's out of your control. Yeah. What was in your control was her, how she was transported to the hospital, potential delays there, perhaps some of the most difficult things to deal with.
Yeah, it was a difficult, I mean, could have been partially our fault, but when we put on the emergency call, I don't think they realised how much of an emergency it was. So when we met them at the Hull in Remelton, her husband was driving, I was in the back. The ambulance man came very slowly and was trying to talk to Sarah, and I was like panicking, saying, you know, she's unconscious, you know, she hasn't been breathing. She's like, I didn't want to say that while her husband was driving, because he was obviously very worried as well. So when they arrived, they soon realised how much of an emergency it was, and they just probably weren't equipped, you know, and it could have been our fault because we didn't explain it to them. But even the blue lights and everything else, and they turned a corner, but she wasn't even strapped in, you know, when she came on top of me. And then just arriving at the hospital, they just weren't prepared, and I can't blame them for it, because after that they were great. When we arrived into the hospital, I just followed in, and obviously it was a severe emergency. She was in resus and they had to cut her clothes off and they had to get at her heart straight away. So then they noticed that I was in the room and they were screaming at me to get out, and it was just traumatic. And when I went to reception, they were asking me, what's her name? And I couldn't even remember. And then they were like, is this your sister? And I was like, I couldn't even think.
Wow.
It was tough, you know, very tough.
But that tragedy revisited again, though, very shortly thereafter.
Yeah. And I think when you go through something like that with your sister and everyone's grieving, you never imagine that anything bad is going to happen again.
That's the worst thing that could ever happen.
You know, people say, oh, you're so young for something like that to happen. And
And then my partner, Chris, we were really in love and we'd bought a house together. I was only 19 when I bought my first house.
And I imagine what you'd went through, your sister, that tests the relationship.
Yeah.
And obviously the relationship passed that test with flying colours because you were planning your future together and building a house or buying a house. And
he was a great fella. He was really outdoorsy, surfing, paragliding, great swimmer, everything. And just a lovely person to be around. And we bought our house. He loved the Downings. He loved outdoors. He loved his dog, Barney. And he wanted to go back there. So I just knew in my gut. I remember saying to my dad, Chris wants to go back to the Downings this weekend. And he was like, and what? You know, wasn't the Downings that, you know, caused your sister to die?
Mm-hmm.
And so I gave in. But the whole way down the journey, thoughts and gut feeling of, why am I going here? This was Sarah's last journey. This. And sure enough, we went hiking that day and we had a picnic with us. And we went up across Tranarossan Beach, up the hill, and I was knackered when I got to the top of the hill. He was a lot fitter than me. So we laid out the picnic or whatever, and he would just mosey along with the dog in and around. But the dog came back himself. And I thought it was a joke, and I was shouting, this isn't funny, you know. But not once did it cross my mind that anything bad had happened. So I kept thinking, I'll go to where he might have went, and then I'll go back to the picnic area. And then maybe he went back to the car, or maybe he went up to the caravan. So this back and forth went on, and I just went in shock. I thought, how can I ring my family again and tell them that something has happened? Because then it makes it serious. And the alarm was raised then. I just thought people were being crazy. I was thinking he'd hurt his leg or something like that. And he was missing for 2 days. There was a land and sea search. And the whole time you go through hope, bewilderment, disbelief. But I never let it under my head once that something tragic had happened. And after 2 days then he was found, he had drowned.
It's astonishing. And it's like that 2 days where your sister was on life support.
Yeah.
You kind of felt you knew what was going on.
Yeah.
And in this 2 days, there was almost false hope rather than the reality you faced with you.
Yeah.
And what happened to him?
He drowned. There was an inquest on his death and everything as well. And we believe that the dog slept because on a big verge, there was like, it looked like dog.
Yeah.
Like he slept and maybe he slept. But I was thinking, even if he did slip under the water, I can't believe that he would have drowned because he was such a good, healthy, fit man.
He was an outdoorsy swimmer, wasn't he? He was climbing, he was a surfer and everything.
So it was just, when I heard that there was divers, I was like, why?
Yeah.
Like, I never thought for 1 second that he could be in the water, you know.
How do you cope? You get to the point now where I presume you're thinking, can I even leave the house? Because if I do, could something happen? I mean, you know, who was your support network at that point? Because they had to be there for you.
Yeah, all my parents. My parents were great, but it makes life so fragile and it scared me. I was only 19, you know, so within a year I'd lost my best friend, my sister and my partner. And having to go back to a house that we'd just bought that we were renovating, and it was so tough. It was so tough that I had to get my mum to sleep in the bed with me every night for about a year because I was so afraid of the universe and what else is out there and why has this happened. And
have you struggled with allowing people to get close to you because you could fear that you might lose them?
Yes, I do have a big issue with that, and certainty is a big thing for me. You know, I was very vulnerable after Chris died, and you know, I wasn't ready to get into the relationship that I got into, and I ended up married to him for nearly 20 years. But definitely,
that's the father of your two children. Yeah.
Yes, so certainty is a big thing for me, and I think what I wanted after Chris died was just, I had spent a couple of years with him building a relationship and we were so, so happy together that I just wanted that again quick.
Yeah.
I didn't want to have to find someone and go through all that years again. I just wanted to be happy and I wanted to settle down, and it wasn't the right decision.
Is there a sense that maybe your vulnerability was exploited?
I wouldn't go that far.
Okay.
I think it just wasn't the right relationship. It wasn't healthy for me at all, but I didn't even notice that until I started to get mature in myself and get my own strength back. And that only happened 3 years ago. So it's unfortunate that it took me that long, but I just shouldn't have got into it. I wasn't healed. I wasn't strong.
Yeah, but things happen, don't they? Because, you know, obviously the children come along.
It's meant, yeah, and I wouldn't regret it.
That, that then defers maybe for another while, and then there's always something. Whilst 20 years seems like a long time, it's also to some extent a blink of an eye because you're focused on school uniforms and your business career and absolutely everything. In the midst of that, pretty much then smack bang in the middle, is that when you joined the Shandon? What did you do before? So you were at the paper and still, even when you've really sadly lost Chris, you were still with the paper at that point, were you? Did you pack in work or did you continue to go to work? I know your mother comforted you and she even lay beside you for a year, but did you keep going?
Oh, yeah. I never took, outside of just the typical that you take off when someone isn't, you know, when you have a bereavement. My whole family was like that. We just went back to work. I didn't take any time off. I didn't, thankfully, suffer from any mental health issues or anything. I just kept going. So after the Derry News, I went into hospitality. Started off in the White Horse Hotel in Derry as a sales and marketing manager. And then I moved to Donegal then, must be 17, 18 years ago now. And I started as a sales and marketing manager in the Mount Errigal Hotel for 7 years.
And that was really that was when you really started to get into where you are at now. Just in relation to the strength, outward strength that you would have shown and going back to work, and it clearly was bred into you to some extent. Did you have to, did you face scrutiny for not being sad enough, for not being broken enough?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
But I do know things get said behind your back, you know, and one of the things that stands out to me was when I was grieving Chris and I was standing beside his coffin in a closed coffin, a person in my family, now I know who they are, not my family as such, not quite my immediate family.
In the circle.
In the circle, said that girl will amount to nothing because of what I'd been through. And I just thought the judgment on that. And if I'd have heard that at that time, would that have changed the trajectory of my life? But this person is still in and around the family. And I just think...
Have you ever not had it out with them?
I will say something to them at some point. I definitely will. But it's that gross judgment of someone when you've never been through anything like that yourself, even at your old age now. Like, he's in his 60s and you've never been through half of what I've been through.
No.
And you judged me and I was literally a teenager. So things like that stand out. And I know people probably did think, oh, she's going to crash, you know, at times. And there's times I did behind closed doors.
There is something about grief that there's default things people say. You know, someone has a miscarriage, sadly, you can go again.
Yeah.
Or stuff, you know, like, so thankfully some of that language now is going out of common public discourse. But if someone is holding themselves together or have prepared themselves well or have a political mental strength, and then people say, no, it'll hit you, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just something someone says. But I think people should just sort of say, hold on a second, everyone deals with things differently. We do some of it privately, we do something of it publicly. We could be privately getting counselling, who's to say? But I hear it so often. And I think then people who are bereaved almost start feeling guilty that they're not worse than they are. I don't know, it sounds like nothing, but I've seen it more often than I should have that it happens.
Yeah. And it's so true, even going through divorce, the first thing a single mum does is she tries to appear strong for her girls. And sometimes then they can nearly feel sorry for the other party because they're acting like a victim, maybe, you know. So I've learned so much even through that as well, that let people see your emotion. I've learned to do that lately. I used to be so strong and I'll get on with it and I'll get it done. But now I'm definitely more, I'm finding this difficult and I might need a moment or whatever.
But did you must have seen that in the past as a weakness?
I did. That's the way kind of Ballymac was. You know, you fought your, you fought your way out of the park sometimes. People were throwing punches. So yeah, my dad always said, you know, if you get under a row, make sure you throw the first jab. You know? So like that's the kind of upbringing that we had.
How big a decision was it to, and I know I kind of jumped past this, but I wasn't really sure how comfortable you were. We're not going to go into the ins and outs of it, don't get me wrong. How big of a decision was it to get out of that relationship and go through the process of actually terminating it by way of divorce? Yeah.
It took years. I think from day one, I knew that it wasn't right, but I wasn't mature enough or emotionally strong enough. Thankfully, our two girls, I mean, they're amazing. Two gorgeous girls, such lovely, mannerly. They're just lovely and I'm so proud of them. So I'll never regret
the relationship. That's the Ballymac
in them,
isn't
it? Yeah, that's the good side. So definitely, like, it was coming to an end for about 10 years, if I'm honest. And I suppose it wasn't healthy for me. That's all I can say. But in terms of our family unit, our family life and what appearances, it seemed happy. And my girls, for the majority of our life as a family, they didn't see anything and they were happy. And the moment
putting that public persona out, how blooming draining is that?
Oh yeah,
living like I don't want to be harsh, but living a lie, let's say, call that for 10 years, that takes a lot of energy, and it's not a good lie, right? It's a lie that's coming from a very good place, but that's that's stress on top of stress on top of stress.
Well, you're taught to, like, my parents are devout Catholics. You know, marriage is marriage, and you just. It just, I suppose what actually the relationship lasted so long as well is because I was building the Shandon. So I was working 7 days a week, 24/7. So that was probably a saving grace at the time as well. But I think the moment that my girls seen how unhealthy the relationship was for me, that was the day that the marriage ended. Wow. And there was no turning back.
Yeah.
Once I realised this is actually the guilt in me, I'm going to stay for my kids. But when I realised this is actually a risk of actually affecting my kids now, that was the rock bottom. That was it. Yeah. And there was no turning back from that moment. Yeah.
As a front-facing person who, you know, you talked about how a comment, obviously from someone who shouldn't have said it earlier in your life, had an impact on you. Were you conscious of the fact that no matter how you might try, that a breakup would be public? It would be it would be talked about, people would be aware of it, you know, you have a profile. Was that something that affected you, bothered you, you didn't care about?
I think in my maturity now, I don't care about what other people think.
But is that amazing how long it takes?
Literally the last couple of years. But prior to that, you know, you would talk to family and, you know, my entire family, there's no divorce. So I'm the youngest and I'm the only one to be going through a divorce. And there's a wee bit of shame attached to it because of old traditions.
Yeah, but the other side of that is, Carolyn, is people living separated.
Yeah.
To avoid the D word.
Yeah.
You know, so they're doing everything other than formalising it.
Yeah,
and because of that stigma that still is there. I think, I could be wrong, but I believe that's the case.
No, you're right, and it's expensive as well.
Yeah, well, that's the other side of it, isn't it?
So, yeah, no, it's definitely, like, it's like anything in life, I don't regret anything, you know, like even what I've went through in my marriage, and look at the two girls I have now and the happiness that we have. And it takes a strong person to walk away from a family unit and the risk of, like, affecting your kids. So people that actually have the strength to do that, they're actually putting their kids first, really.
Yeah, 100%. And if dealt with correctly, which obviously you did as much as you can, kids are very resilient.
They are.
They really are very resilient and they're really amazing, strong people. That doesn't mean we put too much on them, but as parents, you know what they're capable of absorbing and what have you. And it's clear that you got that spot on with your two girls, isn't it?
Yes, two girls, Lena and Eva.
So your period with in the Mount Errigal.
Yes.
8 years, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, seven. Seven. I think it was about seven or 8 years.
Let's not split hairs. Yeah. I don't have any to spare. No, 7, 8 years. Again, that's in Letterkenny, so people are going to know you, right? You build up your reputation there. What was your time at the Mount Errigal like?
Oh, it was brilliant. I mean, at the time, it was like the recession. So it was 2008, 2009. And the hotel that I was working in previously in Derry City was just round the corner from where I lived. And even the owner there was like, are you crazy? There's a recession and you're going to leave and there's probation, you know. But when I came to the Mount Errigal, I just had a job. I had to prove that I could do the job, and it was sales and marketing. And it was great. Terry and Loretto trusted me to do the job. They gave me the space and we had some great achievements. We were in the top 10 in Ireland for social media. We were winning awards. You know, we were the first kind of hotel that was on social media. Mm-hmm. And we implemented strategies in revenue management, and our occupancy was actually growing during the recession. And then we introduced the Santa package, and that was a great success there too. And we got lots of national conferences. It was a great time. Yeah. And I learned so much.
And then coming out of recession with the tailwind of the success you were having.
Yeah.
I just wonder, because sometimes the space that you're working in, and this is nothing against Terry or anyone else involved, right? But, you know, they have to trust you, because sometimes it can be hard to explain how you monetize being really good in social media. Mm-hmm. Or you monetize that you've got, hey, do you know on that last post we got such and such amount of, you know, yeah. Like, but yeah, whereas, you know, we want 75% occupancy all year round, right? So there had to be a bit of trust there, but you had to sell internally as well, I'd say.
Well, that's it, you know, and it was all new to everyone then. Even like no hotel was really on social media. Hotels back then, they weren't really doing revenue management strategies, or they were just literally a price midweek weekend and that was it. And then when the Celtic Tiger days were over, everything went flat because people didn't have the money. Mm. So we introduced a very dynamic rate strategy, and it worked so, so well, you know, and it was a great success. And I think once I got the first success over, they did definitely trust me. And it's like, I didn't really want to leave there because I had such a good relationship with them, and they let me do my job, and I was proud of what we were achieving. And then to go into the Shandon, a dilapidated
hotel.
Well,
how did that happen? How did you end up moving from the Errigal to the Shandon?
It was just an advertisement I seen in the paper, and it just struck me. Our coastal hotel needs a general manager, and sure, okay, yes, I wasn't a general manager, but I had a lot of experience. And I went for it. And as soon as I seen the property, I wanted it so bad. The first interview I'd done with our boss, he was like, nah, because like he was from the construction trade and I was from the hotel background. Mm-hmm. So the questions weren't flowing and the answers weren't great. And I actually went back then and said, can you just give me a chance? Just let me do a proposal for you.
It was a no first, really, effectively, or at least a negative first interview.
Oh, yeah. I was literally not even getting a second interview.
Wowzers, yeah.
So I wrote him an email and I said, just forget that first interview. Let me come back and I'll do a presentation. I'll show you. I'll do a pre-opening timeline. I'll tell you who we're going to employ, what we're going to pay them, what we need to purchase. And I'll tell you what businesses we're going to target, and I'll give you some projections. And I give them the projections, food, beverage, spa, accommodation. Did that and then got the job.
Mm.
And then when he went back to London, then I had started, I said, so when are you coming over? Do we have a meeting? And he goes, what, you done an interview? Off you go then.
Yeah.
And that was it.
But that opportunity, that door would never have opened if you hadn't pushed it so hard. Because that must have been a convincing email. Do you still have it?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Frame it.
Well.
Well, wait till you own the Shandon outright and then frame it.
Well.
Are you the type that visualizes that you go in and you see stuff that maybe not everyone does? That could go there. We could do this here if we just do that. You come across as that type of a person, that you have a wee bit of a head start in sort of visualizing what could happen and then making it happen.
Yeah, I think I know how to make money. I think that's the key. I'm absolutely terrible in interior design.
That's cold,
and stuff.
Man. But it's that true. Is really cold.
It is, but it's.
I'm setting you up for something else, but now, yeah, go on.
I'm not. I'm actually terrible at interior design. I remember buying, my boss said, go out and get some throws for that relaxation room. And he was like, oh my God, that's like an old people's home. Like, I'm terrible at it, but thank God for ChatGPT now. But in terms of making money and, you know, finding spaces that can turn revenue, and then, you know, coming up with ideas to create weaker demand periods, times that you actually
do be busy. Mm. That would be my strength.
But that seems really logical, right? And you've done it amazingly. You know, people talk about shoulders and all this kind of stuff and spreading it out, and the initiatives you did at Christmas or do at Christmas and other stuff as well. But I presume it is becoming the norm. You see a lot of different hotels sort of probably following in the path you made.
Yeah, well, the Mount Errigal was the first to do it when I was there. And then a lot of people, they do try and copy that incentive, but they don't realise
how
much
work. No, you have to do it right, don't you?
Yeah, it's a lot of work. There's a lot of acting, costumes, logistics. You know, it's a lot of work. Mm. So a lot of people do it, and they maybe don't market it right, or when they do market it, they come and it's not as magical as it should be. So I'm pretty confident that you will have a lot of people copying it, but I don't think they'll compete with us.
And I think, not that I'm on the payroll, I think too, yours is, and I know people will travel from all over the country, but locally, yours is the gold standard. So if someone else tries it, they have to at least match it or exceed it, or there's going to be disappointment. That's an advantage of yours, and you will see hotels try it.
Yeah.
And then you don't see it the next year. You'll see that quite a bit, right?
That's right. Because it is difficult to run that on top of a busy hotel, of lots of fully booked hotel with lots of families needing their breakfast, lunch and dinner and swimming and everything else. So it's a whole new operation, and it's a whole different operation. It's an event management, you know, and we have three duty managers that manage the actual logistics of it each night. And there's just so much thought goes into the magical winter wonderland walkthrough and making sure there's wee changes every year and keeping with the current themes, be it Frozen or whatever else.
It's probably going to be Toy Story this year, isn't it? Toy Story 5 is out, or whatever it might be. That's not really Christmassy and magical. How long were you at the paper? It feels like you were at the paper like 7, 8 odd years, were you?
About five.
Five.
Years,
how long were you at the White?
About two years, and a half, right. And then seven.
Five, seven, eight, nine, ten.
Ten now,
are you starting to get itchy feet? Or is this your forever home now?
I think it's my forever home now, being a shareholder as well.
Well, that's, I was going to come to that. How long have you been a shareholder?
Since 2021.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. And is that something, I don't think it's private, I'm not asking any finances. Yeah. Is that something that you were rewarded with, or is that something that you says, look what I've achieved, if you want me to stick around, these are my T's and C's?
Bit of both. A bit of both.
There was a meeting of minds, right?
I was headhunted by a group of investors that owned a few hotels in the north, and they were offering me a package that was life-changing. So when I presented it to my boss, that's how the negotiations came about then. And he was very happy to give me a bit of skin in the game. He said, because you treat it like it's your hotel anyway.
Yeah.
He said, and you've proven yourself and you've showed that over the last 7 years. So I'm more than happy to involve you in that way.
Brilliant. So that's exciting too. You got your own interest in it as well. Yeah. And you're happy there.
Yeah, I love it. And again, it's all down to the team. Like, we've built a really good team around us. The senior management, as I said, have been with me 10 years. My boss is a great boss, and he trusts us and he lets us come up with these crazy ideas and try them. And it's a great environment to work in, and I'm very grateful for it.
But you will never rest on your laurels or stand still. I don't think you would allow that to happen, would you?
There's lots going on now. We're doing more refurbishment of rooms. We're doing up our relaxation room. We've built a brand new terrace. So we're extending the spa. So there's going to be a lot more outdoor facilities. So it's all very exciting,
Yeah, fantastic. You're happier now.
Oh, yes.
You know, you've been through an awful lot. And what I think is really amazing, and it's a great lesson for others, is that you've persevered. Not only have you persevered, but you've excelled through, you know, incredibly difficult times with great challenges. And I think in some way you've not weaponized it, but you've focused that emotion, whatever that emotion is, grief, anger, whatever it is, and focused into a drive and a positivity in your life. That's how it feels. But now you're happy, right?
Very happy now. And I think a lot of people will see, you know, on social media or whatever, of the job that I have and all that, and they just assume that I was lucky, but they don't realise what I had to go through to actually get here and still be sane.
But you're less inclined now to try and prove them wrong, aren't you? You just go with it. You understand.
I don't mind.
People,
I mean,
talk, like,
that's,
who cares?
It doesn't bother me at all. But definitely, like, all the success in the world, I think success now is having peace
You know, that's just having peace of mind, knowing that you've had a good day at work and that you've got your kids around you and they're happy and they're safe and they're stable. That's, to me,
well,
that's success.
Well, it's everything, isn't it? That is success. And I suppose it's interesting because of your experience growing up in Derry and moving on to education and the options and what have you. And in a way, you know, you are so successful because of where you come from. Do you struggle to, and hopefully the girls don't listen and feel we're talking about them and give them cringe, but, you know, what's the right thing to do? You can't say, well, do you want to go to study in Rome? We could do that. Or, you know, it's that balance between, you know, finding their own path and what they really want to do.
Yeah, I think that there's a difficulty in that when you have come from where I've come from, and then my kids have a stable life and they have opportunities. Like, they can come, they can train in the Shandon. Like, my daughter Elena is a spa therapist. But sometimes there's a wee bit of tension between me and them when I feel like they don't appreciate the opportunities that maybe I didn't have. But in fairness to them, like, my daughter Elena, she didn't like school. She left early and she studied as a spa therapist, and she's doing absolutely amazing. And my younger daughter Eva now, she's actually started to train on reception. But Elena's grand because she works in a different building and she's very different to me. She's very calm. She's very spa-like. Whereas Eva is like me. So she is very feisty, opinionated. She's telling me about the policies and procedures that need to be improved already, and she's only been there 2 days.
Fantastic. And you were such a vocal 16-year-old. How could you disregard that, right?
True.
And I suppose, too, it's about teaching them, is it that there's no glass ceiling?
That's it. And that wherever you start from in life, like, nobody would have thought I'd end up where I am today. Mm-hmm. You know, especially that man in the wake room saying she'll amount to nothing.
We're going to have to get him in for a podcast. Is that, do you have to speak to him, do you?
Is it
one of the legacy issues?
It's what's happened is when there was a write-up in a newspaper there a few weeks ago, someone brought that information to me. So I've been, it hurt me at first because I thought, that's a cruel thing to say about a young girl. But now I'm kind of like waiting my chance to just say something to him.
Maybe they're listening. But they know, the funny thing is through the course of the show and all, I'd interview a lot of people that say were bullied when they were kids or whatever, and there'd be one particular kid in their fifth class or something that called them names, and it affected them through the teenage years. And I've chatted to guys who were in their 70s and almost well up at that. And I often think the person that said that forgot it that evening, just went on above of their life, just carried on, probably couldn't even remember their name.
Imagine.
But that one person would have to carry it for the rest of life and impact them. There's waves. The point being, A, it's easier said than done to disregard it, but B, you know, think before you speak.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And understand the power of words.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just glad that that wasn't said to me at that tender age and what I was going through at the time.
I feel you might have weaponized it again and done something else. So what are your goals and ambitions? What do you want to do, even beyond the Shandon? Because I presume, you know, the stuff you could do alongside what you want to do, and it's not a case of diluting your attention. But is there a bucket list stuff, something, an itch you have to scratch?
I think I've achieved more than I ever hoped for in terms of
that's
career.
That's great contentment.
It really is. Like, and I'm really happy where I am. I think the goal is just a happy life for my girls and peace and making sure that they have good self-esteem and they feel confident and that they don't get into a relationship that is, you know, not healthy for them. You know, that's the goal in life.
Balance with, you have to make your own mistakes.
Well, that too, unfortunately, but
you can set down foundations that helps them avoid
just
that.
Show them what it's like to be happy and to be, and I suppose too, I was very lucky. My career gave me freedom where I could look after my girls myself and provide for them all by myself. Yeah. Whereas if I hadn't had that success, I mightn't have been as lucky.
Lastly, I don't necessarily, we talk quite a lot on the radio programme, you know, about the state of the tourism industry, what needs to be done, what can be done and stuff. And I want to focus more on you in this chat, so we might park that. But one thing I am curious of, and you could simply say, no, that's crazy, Greg. I think there's a few people, if not more than a few, within the industry, tourism, hotel industry, whatever it might be, that are on the same page as you and really see where Donegal could be, yeah. You know, treating it as one big Shandon or one big whatever yeah. it might be. And then maybe there's other laggards, and I don't mean that negatively, yeah. that maybe don't share that vision, but you need them to come along to be what we possibly could be.
Yeah.
Is that the case in Donegal tourism? And if so, is there a frustration there that if we could get everyone on the same page with the right motivation, what could be achieved could be huge?
I think that there's been a lot of work done in the county this last couple of years, and Donegal Tourism is doing an amazing job. They're really engaging with the hoteliers because we need the hotels to bring the tourists into the county. And they're listening to us, they're working with us, they're... You know, we're really collaborating now, and with Fáilte Ireland and the people around the table in the branch, they all want the same things. And we're the biggest employer mostly in the county. So it's all going very, very well and coming together beautifully. And I have to say, Donegal Tourism and Fáilte Ireland, they've been really backing us, the hoteliers.
That's great. It's great to hear high praise of the organisations that yeah. you need to be doing yeah. their shift.
Definitely.
It's a good space.
It is.
Carolyn, thank you.
Thank you.
Do people call you Caroline a lot?
Carolyn, they call me, or Cara. Some things are worse, but we'll not repeat them.
Well, so you've heard. Well, I get Greg, Craig, frickin' everything. Sean.
I get Carla, Caroline, Carlan. It's grand.
Listen, continued success. Love to all the family. It's great to see you in a happy space.
Thank you.
With everything that you've been through, and continued success.
Thank you so much, Greg. Thank you so much for joining us.
And a big thanks once again to Carolyn. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of the Greg Hughes Podcast. Just to remind you that you can listen to all previous episodes wherever you get your podcasts. And we release a new episode every Friday morning at 11 a.m. If you enjoyed it, please tell your friends, share the podcast out there. It's all very much appreciated. If you have any feedback, comments, or even a guest to suggest, feel free to contact the researcher and producer of this podcast. That's Caroline Orr. And the best way to contact her is via email, caroline.orr@highlandradio.com. But for me, Greg Hughes, we'll chat to you again real soon.